More than just the final send-off for a long-gone one-term president. With Jimmy Carter's passing, Washington marking two legacies. That of a peanut farmer turned governor of a southern state whose rise to power embodied a backlash after the Vietnam War and Watergate. And that of a leader voted out of the White House after a hostage crisis and an energy crisis, but whose second act in life made him a moral authority on issues such as peace-building, election monitoring, and affordable housing. The funeral comes in the final days before another one-term president leaves office. And as Carter's loss begat the Reagan years and a backlash against his vision of the social contract between citizens and their government, what does the coming presidency mean at this moment, both for the U.S. and for the world? Today in the France 24 debate, how will history remember Jimmy Carter? Joining us from Washington, correspondent Fraser Jackson. Good to see you.
Good to be with you. Thank you, Francois.
Also in the U.S. Capitol, he was a speechwriter in the Clinton administration, journalist and historian Andrew Yarrow. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
Susan Neiman is a Georgia-born philosopher, director of the Einstein Forum think tank. Welcome from Ireland. Where in Ireland are you?
I'm on the west coast of Kerry.
Okay, well, welcome to the France 24 debate. Welcome as well to Bernard Harcourt, professor of law and political science at Columbia University Law School. You are the author of Cooperation, a Political, Economic, and Social Theory. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, François.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24 debate. And a reminder, if you're on the go, you can listen to the show wherever podcasts are streamed. Yeah, not the longest-serving president, but the longest-living one. He died at age 100. And after passing away, Jimmy Carter honored with a state funeral attended by five of his successors. That's another record. And Tony Kerrigan has more.
On a brisk morning in Washington, D.C., cannons fired and the band played Hail to the Chief. This is the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, left the Capitol for the National Cathedral in his coffin. It's an anthem he had tried to abolish, a man who often rejected the pomp and ceremony surrounding the presidency. Among those who eulogized the Democratic president from 1977 to 1981, Joe Biden, as one of his last acts in office, a task entrusted to him by Carter himself, paying tribute to what he called six decades of deep friendship.
The story of a man who never let the tides of politics divert him from his mission to serve and shape the world. The man had character. Many think he was from a bygone era, but in reality, he saw well into the future.
While Jason Carter, grandson of the deceased, struck a lighter and affectionate note, reminiscing about not the statesman but the man, humble and eccentric, and his home, of a different time but filled with warmth.
They were small town people who never forgot who they were. Yes, they spent 4 years in the governor's mansion and 4 years at the White House, but the other 92 years they spent at home in Plains, Georgia.
Presidential funerals follow a set of conventions but can include personal touches. In Carter's case, the ceremony was tinged with idealism. Two country music stars performed John Lennon's Imagine.
You may say I'm a dreamer.
And in memory of a man who put peace in the Middle East at the heart of his foreign policy, Let There Be Peace on Earth played on the piano. I hope someday. All five living U.S. presidents were in attendance. Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and even Donald Trump, who repeatedly called Carter a terrible president on the campaign trail. Seated next to his predecessor, giving a rare semblance of bipartisan unity at a fraught time in American politics.
Yeah, five people in succession, whether monarchs or presidents, heads of state, embody a nation. And in a sign of the times, they're living longer, 100. Carter, the oldest former president. And yet the current one, Joe Biden, arrived in Washington before him. Biden first elected to the Senate in 1972, Carter as president in 1976. Is that the first element of his legacy, Andrew Yarrow, that he lived to be 100?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's an important element, but I think really his post-presidency, as so many people have said, I mean, he was a man who, you know, fought for decades to combat disease, malnutrition, to fight for peace, for human rights, and, you know, projected decency, a kind of decency that, you know, we really don't see in political figures, at least in the United States these days.
And we're seeing images of his UN ambassador, Andrew Young, who is one of the leaders of the civil rights movement. Susan Neiman, when Carter becomes governor in 1970, he hadn't spoken much about civil rights. And then he said the time has come to put segregation behind us, to embrace equal rights for blacks and minorities. How has the view of him changed over the years in Georgia?
Look, whatever he had to do to get elected, what he did once he was in office, and as everyone has said, particularly since he was out of office, radiated a kind of moral clarity which we have not seen, unfortunately, since. And he was not only, he left the Southern Baptist Church because of their policies on racism. He was the very first American president to visit Africa. I just found that out. I found it kind of incredible that no one had done that before Carter. But it was certainly an important thing. So I think there's a kind of national sadness at the moment that goes quite deep. Biden tried to say he's not a remnant of a bygone era, but I would like to see some more of his strength of character in politics today.
Ben Arco, you agree that perhaps Joe Biden's wrong that he on that point?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, this is there's a lot of political reconstruction that's going on right now, and that there's a lot of politics involved in the way in which we remember Jimmy Carter. Definitely a modest man, by contrast to some other recent presidents, right? But not that different, I would say, than a Barack Obama, say. And in terms of the years after the presidency, he had a formative time, but not dramatically different, say, than a Clinton. Or even an Obama right now, you know, it's so. I mean, Trump broke the mold in a way with kind of the post presidency, right?
Yeah. So we have today this sort of it really felt like harking back to the past, Fraser Jackson. The tributes came from both Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, there was a real a mixture across the board there, and notably from the son of Gerald Ford, who, of course, Jimmy Carter succeeded in office. And the two men had a distinct rivalry, which then became a very dear friendship. And we heard from Gerald Ford's son that his father, who had obviously passed away some years ago, had written this eulogy for Jimmy Carter and asked Jimmy Carter if he would speak at his funeral. And Jimmy Carter said, I will, but only if you speak at mine. So there was a real friendship between the two men. So we heard from the Republican side of the aisle, and of course, the more glaring representation of that at the funeral was indeed the presence of Donald Trump and Mike Pence, his vice president, who was also in attendance. Pence, the two men shaking hands, although notably Karen Pence, the wife of Mike Pence, didn't shake hands with Donald Trump or Melania Trump. That is receiving quite a bit of interest and traction online. But there was also that representation by the Democratic side, of course, a number of Democratic presidents there, and of course, a eulogy from the president himself, who was also friends with Jimmy Carter, with Joe Biden speaking very fondly of the man that he knew for decades, who he'd endorsed during his run in the 70s, and who he'd spent many dinners with alongside both of their wives as well.
Andrew Yarrow, were you paying any particular close attention to the political theater of who shook whose hand for how long? I mean, when you saw all those former presidents and vice presidents there?
Well, I was struck by how Donald Trump seemed to be, you know, talking Barack Obama's ear off, and Obama wasn't really responding other than in kind of short answers. I thought the handshake with Mike Pence was certainly a bit of theater after, you know, 4 years ago, just 4 years and a couple days ago, Trump was inciting his supporters to hang Mike Pence. And Mike Pence, of course, did the right thing in confirming Joe Biden's election on January 6, 2021. So, yeah, certainly a lot of theater out there, but I'm glad that Donald Trump was there, despite the fact, you know, he's been criticizing Carter on the campaign trail. He made his comments about the Panama Canal, which, of course, right. At least President-elect Trump was there. So,
yeah, the future Nobel Peace Laureate Jimmy Carter, who, when he was president, proved quite the peacemaker. Carter sealing the Camp David Accords and the first normalization of ties between Israel and one of its neighbors, not just any neighbor, Egypt, 5 short years after the two countries had gone to war.
So let us now lay aside war. Let us now reward all the children of Abraham who hunger for a comprehensive peace in the Middle East.
Susan Neiman, when you hear that clip of Jimmy Carter from 1978, is it a bygone era? I mean, how many of our viewers are wishing that there could be some kind of peace in the Middle East right now?
Let's speak straightforwardly. The most important thing, perhaps, I hope, that Carter did was not just the Camp David Accords, but in his post-presidency, he was first to call what's going on in Israel-Palestine a state of apartheid. That's something for which he was seriously criticized. In the meantime, not just every civil rights organization in the world, including the Israeli human rights organizations, but anybody who has spent 10 minutes on the West Bank knows that technically apartheid just means two systems of laws for two different peoples. And that's what's going on. So let me express a faint hope that particularly in Carter's post-presidency, he was making a voice for the future. I also wanted to add, by the way, that I do think that Barack Obama has the kind of character, potentially, that Jimmy Carter had. I think being the first African-American president put him under a burden that we still today don't know how to weigh. And I think it made it much more difficult for him to act in a post-presidency than Carter does. But let's see, he's still a young man.
Still a young man. And Jimmy Carter's diplomatic achievements also included, when he was in office, returning sovereignty of the Panama Canal. Andrew Yarrow alluding to it a moment ago, to Panama itself. An achievement, well, called into question this very week.
Giving the Panama Canal is why Jimmy Carter lost the election, in my opinion, more so maybe than the hostages. The hostages were a big deal. But if you remember, and nobody wants to talk about the Panama Canal now because, you know, it's inappropriate, I guess, but because it's a bad part of the Carter legacy. But he was a good man. Look, he was a good man.
So a lot to unpack in that statement. Donald Trump alluding to the Iran, the U.S. Embassy staff that were held hostage in Iran,
right.
And saying that the Panama Canal was actually a more important reason as to why he failed in his bid for re-election in 1980.
Well, that's not correct, clearly. I mean, clearly, Carter lost because of the hostage crisis. There was no question. I mean, the last year of his presidency was consumed by that hostage crisis, and every American was consumed by it. It's almost hard to remember how important that was in terms of kind of America's presence in the world and the feeling of the American perception of its own kind of weakness at that point. But I think that this conversation, all of this conversation, both during kind of and post, is very interesting because, I mean, the biggest contrast here is between someone who tried to, in a way, tried to cooperate, tried to negotiate along many fronts. Panama was one of them, and there were problems in Panama. Trump is not really giving the history of what was going on, but there were revolts. This, you know, the Panama Zone was a contested area. It was actually viewed by Panamanians as an apartheid state, actually, and there were revolts, and there were shootings and whatnot. I mean, so there was a real controversy going on over Panama and America's control of that zone, 10 mile zone. But similarly with the Israeli and Palestinian negotiations. I mean, it was a presidency that was based on trying to negotiate solutions, trying to cooperate, and I think that that's the sharpest difference right now with what we have. And I think in general, the American public is not always as receptive to that as to someone like Reagan, who would come after.
So the American public thinks Trump might is right, and you don't act as a negotiator and enforce multilateral deals and international rules.
Well, I think that unfortunately, I think that that is, I think that's reflected in the elections. I think that's reflected in the way in which Trump gets reelected. And in the way in which someone like Carter was resoundingly defeated, there is a way in which the kind of politics which Carter embodied struggles with popular reception.
Andrew Yarrow, you agree?
I do. It's interesting. I was looking back 35 years ago. I covered for the Times a conference reassessing Carter's presidency, and Rosalind Carter, his wife, said at that conference that, you know, people, Americans, want their country to be tough, and if Jimmy, as she put it, had bombed Tehran, you know, maybe he would have been reelected, but the hostages would have died. And instead, he persisted and persisted, and we went through 400 and some excruciating days of the hostage crisis. And the Iranian, the Ayatollah only released them moments after Carter left office on January 20, 1981, but the hostages were alive. No one died. I mean, yes, people died in the failed attempt in 1980 to save the hostages, the helicopters that went down in the Iranian desert, but the hostages did not die. And Carter succeeded in that regard. And yes, maybe if he had attacked Iran, launched a full-scale attack, maybe he might have been reelected. But, you know, that's counterfactual history.
And let me put this to Fraser Jackson here. Donald Trump's statement there, which was fact-checked, as you heard earlier, by Bernard Arcourt, Is that just part of the news cycle now? It's been normalized, this kind of talk. I mean, this is, again, he made this statement on Monday, so this is 3 days ahead of the man's funeral.
Well, I think, of course, you know, now that Donald Trump is coming back into office, the fire hose of news that became so widely used back when during his first term is definitely starting to come back out of the garden shed, and it's definitely going to be used again. Of course, Donald Trump is somebody who says so many different things, and even just in one of those press conferences, that press conference went on for 72 minutes, which is a mammoth length for a press conference, and so much news and so many headlines were made just from that one conference. So once this starts happening on a daily basis or almost daily basis, so of course, the news cycle is going to pick up in terms of speed. I also just wanted to quickly look at something Joe Biden said during his eulogy towards President Carter. He said that some people would say that Jimmy Carter was, the last of a bygone era, but actually he was looking forward to the future. But I think if you look at the future, you look at the present that's coming in just over 10 days' time, in 11 days' time, and you compare him to Jimmy Carter, the only two things that those men really had in common are the fact that they were both outsiders in Washington. Donald Trump is somebody who has spent his entire life wanting to be accepted by the elites in New York, and then ultimately here in D.C. has gone against the grain of what is the normally done thing here. Jimmy Carter was the same, but I think it's fair to say that is where the similarities end. If you look at Jimmy Carter's speech about the crisis of confidence speech, for example, when he spoke about American materialism and moving away from that and getting back to how we can best serve each other and help each other, that is poles apart from the kind of election campaign that Donald Trump ran over the course of the last year or so, and poles apart from what you hear people want. When you talk to people, they talk about what they have in their lives and what the financial freedoms and how much better off they want to be. That is a very different world to the world that Jimmy Carter was pushing for. And I think Donald Trump really is a reflection of the kind of moment that we're in American history more than anything else.
We're going to hear a clip from that speech that you reference in a moment. But first, Susan Neiman, you heard Fraser there talking about Americans wanting outsiders. In the case of Donald Trump, we've diagnosed that several times on this show. In the case of Jimmy Carter, 1976, it's after the Watergate scandal, and Americans had lost faith in government.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think they have still. But can we go back to your original question when you asked about the American public? And please remember that only 49.9% of the people who actually voted for Donald Trump. He's lying as usual and talking about having a mandate. He does not. Okay. And we're not even talking about all the people who didn't vote. There have been reams and reams of interviews and information about what moved voters. No one said that there's an exception. Foreign policy played a very tiny role in the election. The only place where it seems to have played a role is in a very small number of voters who refused to vote at all because they objected to Biden's position on unconditionally giving weapons to blow up Gaza. And those were by no means Arab Americans in Michigan. It was the largest student protest in the country since the Vietnam War, okay? So I think it's it's a grave mistake to conclude from a 49.9% vote that has been analyzed thousands of times in the last 2 months to an idea that Americans have a particular view of foreign policy. The last thing I'd like to remind us of, and I haven't looked up the numbers lately, but not too long ago, there was a story that and a true story, one needs to add, that 15% of Americans, only 15% of Americans had passports, that is, had been outside the country. And that included people who were certainly well off enough to travel. Americans also rarely have the kind of time to see other countries because they don't get vacation time. So I don't think we can conclude anything whatsoever about American views on foreign policy from this election.
What we have, though, is, and that brings us back to what the speech that Fraser was referencing to, different views on values. In July of 1979, arguably the other big reason why Carter didn't get reelected, the energy crisis. It had Americans suffering crippling shortages at gas stations, big inflation. Jimmy Carter gave what became known as his crisis of confidence speech, one in which he acknowledged that for the first time, America's faith in the future was rattled. People didn't think that the next generation would necessarily be better off than theirs. And that, quote, too many of us now tend to worship self-indulgence and consumption.
We are at a turning point in our history. There are two paths to choose. One is a path I've warned about tonight. The path that leads to fragmentation and self-interest. Down that road lies a mistaken idea of freedom, the right to grasp for ourselves some advantage over others. That path would be one of constant conflict between narrow interest, ending in chaos and immobility. It is a certain route to failure. All the traditions of our past, all the lessons of our heritage, all the promises of our future point to another path. The path of common purpose and the restoration of American values. That path leads to true freedom.
That, Bernard, went down like a lead balloon with voters.
Yeah. Well, you have to realize how radical that speech was. I mean, it goes against all of the foundation of liberal American thought, of the idea that you pursue your self-interest, right, and that it's good for the common, it's good for everyone else, right? I mean, this country was really, really built on an ideology of, you know, private vices leading to public virtues, and he's really challenging that in that confidence speech.
But he's also saying in that speech that he is speaking as a man of faith, and he was a Christian. He taught Sunday school until just before
he
died.
Right, right.
Isn't that also an American tradition?
You're right. Yeah. It is. But there was almost a don't pursue your individual interests theme to this, right? That almost had a bit of a collective dimension to it. The non-consumerism, the fact that we going down that path is going to be dangerous and lead us astray. I think that's actually pretty radical for American political discourse. And it almost sounded like you know, arguments for degrowth today, right? That you hear today. But that at the time you really didn't hear, and it would lead, of course,
for which environmentalists on this continent are getting pummeled over by their opposition.
Correct, and always get pummeled, right? I mean, there is. I mean, yes. I mean, it's a radical position for which I think Carter got pummeled, for which people today who believe as well in a similar ethic, right, of reducing consumption, reducing, you know, not thinking of GDP as the single measure of everything in life, right, are in a minority, and I think that's what made it so radical at the time, and politically, sadly, counterproductive.
Andrea, I know you devoted an entire book to this topic, so I want to ask you. Speaking from the country that invented what we call in France le Black Friday, just how much was that political suicide, that clip we heard?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I was in France over Black Friday and struck how those American values of buying have really taken over France. But, you know, I'd like to echo the point that Carter's crisis of confidence speech really was a very radical speech. I mean, he was, you know, he had before that speech called a bunch of intellectuals, advisors to Camp David for 9 or 10 days to discuss what was wrong with the country. He read, you know, not only the Bible, but he read a couple of pretty radical books, E.F. Schumacher's Small is Beautiful, one of the great environmental treatises of the early 1970s. Christopher Lash's Culture of Narcissism, certainly an attack on the narcissism, what Tom Wolfe called the me decade. Carter in that speech talked about, you know, how human identity or Americans' identity is no longer defined by, I think, what one does, but what one owns. I mean, a very radical message. You know, and it's not just the message, the philosophy that he put forward, this kind of anti-consumerist philosophy, but trying to talk about solutions to the energy crisis that were really decades ahead of his time. I mean, he was pushing for renewable energy. He put solar panels on the roof of the White House, both things that Ronald Reagan reversed and that the kinds of things that are being challenged now by the incoming administration, policies to support renewable energy that a succession of presidents, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, have also pushed for. But, you know, Carter's vision of a world where, you know, we take stewardship for our planet, for our resources, was very much ahead of its time, and that we don't just consume blindly. So while it was a message that hurt him politically, I think it was a very powerful and correct message. Again, maybe not something he should have said to 65 million people or whatever the number who listened to that speech that summer. But I think it was the right message and ahead of its time.
Susan Neiman, that speech, how do you explain it? Why he said it then and how it resonates now?
Well, I said at the very beginning, I think that Carter had an uncommon moral clarity, despite the fact that George W. Bush used the expression of a kind that we almost never see in politicians. And of course, moral clarity demands something of us, as he said. You know, it sometimes requires our interests taking a back seat to our values. And those were demands that, you know, obviously some people had a hard time accepting. I should also say that what I find so interesting, although I'm holding on to the fact that Donald Trump didn't have an absolute majority, I, like millions of other Americans, are still a bit in shock and mourning that we could go from Jimmy Carter in the space of our lifetimes to a man who is clearly incapable of understanding moral values. I think Trump's handling of the military and his genuine inability to understand that someone could lay down their life or risk their life for something that's not naked self-interest may just be the thing that saves us, because I'm forced to have faith in the military in the next 4 years.
The notion of common good, Bernard Harcourt, what's, because in that speech, by the way, he talks about the common good and how Americans used to, in his view, fight for a bigger ideal. I'm paraphrasing here.
Right. Right.
That notion of common good, can it make a comeback?
Yes, of course. I think it can. I mean, I think we have seen, the country move in a very different direction, actually, since Carter. I mean, and many, when you look at many of the issues that he was dealing with, specifically energy, right? The country has moved in a very different direction than he wanted to push us, right? It was not towards renewable energy. You know, in 2018, the United States becomes the first, the number one producer of crude oil in the world. In 2011, we become number one producer of natural gas, right? We're now the biggest producers of fossil fuels, of crude oil and natural gas in the world. Now, of course, it came out of the energy crisis that Carter was dealing with, faced with. He was proposing a different route, but that's not the route we took. And to a certain extent, you know, it's not the route we took through a number of Democratic administrations, right? It wasn't just Trump that started drilling. It happened through a number of Democratic administrations. So we have taken a different, but that doesn't mean that there isn't another path to be taken. It might require a better presentation or something. It might require more convincing work somehow at convincing people to think more in terms of those common interests.
Andrew Yarrow, when you look at the long arc of history, you had Carter as a backlash to Watergate and the Vietnam War, the acrimony there. You then had Reagan as a backlash to Carter. Are these pendulum swings, is that what we should be looking at when we look at the United States? Or is it just simply that, well, Carter's the last president of the so-called greatest generation of fighting age during World War II, and that it's actually, as we move further and further away from that time when the U.S. was engaged in that global fight of World War II?
Well, I mean, we certainly have had pendulum swings. As has been pointed out earlier, you know, we've had a succession of outsider presidents, beginning with Jimmy Carter. Ronald Reagan was one, Bill Clinton was one, in many ways Barack Obama was one, and certainly Donald Trump is another. You know, has that served us well? Yeah, some of those have been very good presidents. I think Jimmy Carter was a good man. Whether he was a good president is another matter. You know, I saw something in The Economist the other day that was kind of troubling in their obit on Carter in America. His career raised the disturbing thought that it might be impossible for a really effective president to also be a really good man. So, you know, can we get a good man who can articulate messages that are about the common good, that are about really future-oriented policies that save our planet, that help our children and grandchildren, and also be someone who's effective, who gets things done. And Americans have been so disgruntled with their government, really going back to Watergate. I mean, you look back to the late 1950s, early 1960s, you had opinion polls showing 80, 90% of Americans believed that their government was doing the right thing in America, that people in politics, you know, were generally good. I mean, today, if those numbers break 20 or 30%, they do well. So can we get back to that? I don't know. I think it will be a long road.
We have presidents who are living longer and longer. Here in France, by the way, Bernard Arcault, we had a president who was elected at age 39. He's going to have a long life afterwards. Not everybody can be Jimmy Carter in their post-presidency years, though.
No, that's true. That's true.
What should a former president do?
Frankly, I've never understood the traditional mold, of former presidents kind of retiring from politics. And I've never understood why, for instance, they don't become a senator and continue in their political engagements. I mean, because particularly given that you're a former president, it seems like you would have so much influence, you know, as a senator or in the House of Representatives or something. So I've never really understood that role. And in a way, you know, Trump completely broke the mold, right, by not retreating, you know, continuing to fight, then continuing to run, and then, of course, getting elected again. And maybe that will actually change the way that that former presidents in America think of themselves in the future. Certainly not the case for President Biden because of his age, but maybe some future presidents at some future time.
Fraser Jackson, Jimmy Carter, who spent, as we heard in that clip at the beginning from one of his relatives, 92 years of his life in Plains, Georgia. And as we speak, that's where his remains are returning.
Yeah, so now the family will accompany the caskets, Jimmy Carter's caskets, aboard one of those modified Boeing 747 planes, which when the president flies upon them are dictated as being Air Force One. Well, this is the special Air Mission 39 to represent the Jimmy Carter being the 39th president. That air mission will fly Jimmy Carter down to his native Georgia, where he will be transferred to a service in Plains, where he will then be interred on the Carter residence. So he will be surrounded by his family and surrounded by the people he loves in the town that he loved and that he spent a significant chunk of his life in, being down there in Plains, Georgia. So a fitting ending to the life of Jimmy Carter, a man who was from those humble beginnings and ultimately returned there, having achieved the highest office in the land, to then continue his humanitarian work and the work of bettering the community down there as well.
Yeah, it'll Susan Neiman, just a quick final word. How will he be remembered in your native Georgia?
I think very much for his sense of purpose. I mean, this is a hope. Philosophers don't prophesy, but I think his sense of purpose, his sense of decency, and hopefully for something to inspire us as the absolute opposite of the president who's about to be inaugurated next week.
All right, the unambiguous Susan Neiman, many thanks for joining us from the west coast of Ireland. I want to thank as well Andrew Yarrow for being with us from Washington, Fraser Jackson, our correspondent, Bernard Harcourt. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.